morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday morning. John Gerda is our guest this hour, Milwaukee historian, author of 19 books, including The Making of Milwaukee, the first feature-length history of Milwaukee since 1948. John is a busy guy. He's a lecturer, a tour guide, a columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's an 8-time winner of the Wisconsin Historical Society's Award of Merit. And this spring, he delivered his first commencement speech to students at UW-Milwaukee. We really like this speech, and we invited him to come on the air and inspire you. Please, John, come on the radio and inspire all of us. But he'll do just that, I'm sure. And also to hear portions of some addresses from some other famous people. We'll hear from Vice President Joe Biden, a little clip from his speech at the University of Pennsylvania this year. Cory Booker, Conan O'Brien at Harvard in the year 2000, Stephen Colbert at Knox College in 2006, and a very famous speech that's made the rounds on the internet, David Foster Wallace speech at Kenyon in 2005. We'll be welcoming phone calls, and let me tell you how you can reach us, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page, where John already has a message, and there is a picture of John delivering that address, the message, "One of my favorite people." Congratulations, John. That was nice. Hello, John.
Hi, Kathleen.
That's a really tall order to inspire people to give a commencement address, because it can be, many of them are very trite and they use the same phrases. And
sure.
But you went way beyond that. I really did like the speech.
Oh, thank you, Kathleen. Especially at 9 in the morning. It's a little hard to inspire folks. Probably been out the night before.
It was good. And you talked about your own circuitous route to get to where you are right now. Isn't it interesting when you look at what your passion may be, you really discover that by doing some other things first?
Yeah, almost backed into a career. I was working on the south side of the youth center back in the late 60s, early 70s, and began to do some neighborhood research to try to get some more funding for what was not even a shoestring operation. I think we had a budget of $45,000 that was supporting 5 full-time staff, you know, plus rent, utilities, and supplies, all those sorts of things. And I drew the historical portion, and that's when the light bulbs began to go off, and that was 40 years ago.
You also were willing to live on a shoestring for some period of time,
certainly. And it's I've said about the kind of work I do, or any kind of freelancing, there's a great deal of variety and not much security. Yes, there's a trade-off there.
There's something about that particular time, and we're part of the same generation, but as you were speaking to students, you talked about, which I really liked, this historical moment in time. We're all living through it, and to look at the we instead of always the I, look at the good of society, in a sense.
And that's a lot of what history means to me. I think the line I used was an old one, that we are literally all in this together.
Right.
And we are the only link between what went before and what comes after. So we better get it right to the extent that we can. And in this society that is so polarized, so divided, the more that unites us, brings us together, gives us a sense of shared fate, the better. And history does that. You know, we're here as you and I know, you get kind of burrow into our 60s, and the perspective gets a little broader, and you realize how short our time is here, and we should take it seriously.
Yeah. You also looked at the composition of the class, which I found interesting. More females than males, and when you get to graduate school, many more females.
61%
amazing.
Of the advanced degrees were females, and that was an applause line. I hadn't expected it to be, but people clapped. Women have been a majority of the undergrads in America for some time, and I think they overtook males on the PhD level just the last couple of years. Now 61% on the UW-Arms class.
So that's absolutely remarkable.
Yeah, great advancements.
Yeah, and you went back to school. You did the work at Journey House, and you did some investigation of neighborhoods in the area, and then the history part of this in historical geography really captivated you, and you went back to school.
Yeah, I was an English major. which is
that's always helpful, isn't it?
It really is.
Ooh, what am I going to do?
And I came back. This is 1969. I graduated from Boston College and came back here with, as I put it, a rather woolly notion that I would be a poet, but all those jobs seemed to be taken. So I painted houses for a while, worked at Journey House. But after doing this work for 4 or 5 years, I began to realize that know, there may be a career here, and I just needed more tools. I needed to know what in the world I was doing. And UWM very quickly, you know, found a home in the geography department, and it was a great program, very strong urbanist program back then. And I gravitated almost instantly to kind of this intersection between time and place, which is historical geography.
Do you think there's any substantial difference between the time that you graduated and the flexibility that you had to essentially kind of find yourself and what students are facing now? We hear so much about the job market is much tougher, that the possibilities to experiment with what you'll do with your life and to find your passion aren't as great as they used to be. Is that true?
Well, it's hard to quantify. There were so many of us. You know, the baby
yes.
boom, we just flooded the job market. So it was not as if there were jobs waiting for us when we decided that it was time to, you know, come in out of the warm or out of the cold, whichever you prefer, and do something serious and economically sustaining. But I suspect certainly that the kids today, the cohort is smaller, but I think there may be more pressure than we felt to sort of move into those somewhat assigned slots. But there's also, I mean, some of the kids right across the street here from your studios on Wisconsin Avenue, the Sprinkler people in Art Milwaukee and New Milwaukee, they're people who are kind of making their own paths
yes.
today, you know, which I think is exciting. I have three kids, two of whom are in grad school, and they are making their own ways as well. You know, one is in a field called agroecology. The city kid wants to work with producers, agricultural producers. So I think it has always been true and will always be true that you can chart your own path. You know, you can develop your own passion in ways that are satisfying to you and productive to society as well.
You recommend that we look at our values when we decide what we're going to do, and we also need to look at what we're good at. Mm-hmm. How do you determine what you're good at? Do you get that from other people? Did you get from somebody, John, you really have a real feel for being able to write about history, and we love your perspective and what you do is unique. Did somebody tell you that, or did you internally realize, hey, I'm pretty good at this?
No, I think all of us know sometime in grade school, you know, by the time you're 12, whether you can sing
That's
or,
true.
Or
right.
write, you know, or, right. or shoot a basketball or talk in front of people.
That's true.
You know, we have a sense of kind of what we're good at, and you know, there's a feedback that you get. In my case, I wrote one of those first primitive pamphlets about the South Side, and Barbara Dembski, who was my editor at the Crossroads for the Journal Sentinel for a number of years. Back then, her beat was neighborhoods, and she did kind of maybe an 8-inch piece about that pamphlet. There I was in the paper. This is cool. So there is that kind of feedback where you say, maybe people listen. Maybe people find the same things that I find important.
Mm-hmm. You also included, and I never knew this, I read it to Rhonda and KP yesterday, I had no idea that what is now UWM many years ago in the 1800s was a golf course. Talk about putting things in a moment in time. That's amazing.
That was fun. And what I part of the, you know, the job of a commencement speaker is to tell stories. But I talked about the back in 1894 when you have these kind of East Side swells, you know, these sort of nabobs, people of some means. They'd gone down to Chicago, got bit by the golf bug, and came back trying to infect their friends. So they laid out. It was a cow pasture. It was between essentially Hartford and Locust and Downer and I think around Maryland. The heart of the campus, the very heart of the campus. So these guys, they called it pasture pool. They used tomato cans for cups, and they used fishing poles with bandanas on them for flags. And what I did was I kind of, not challenged, but I asked the students to visualize, you know, people in their woolen knickers walking across down the fairway between the Golda Meir Library and the Student Union. And that's the gift of history, you know, that kind of perspective, that sense that our time is not the only one, and will not be the only one. No, we will be as antique to our descendants as our ancestors are to us. And I think that's extraordinarily important to realize.
I think you told them if you look around what you're wearing now, what you think may be high fashion 50 years from now.
Any car on the street would be in a parade. if it were still running. Anything you're wearing would be vintage. and that's guaranteed. That's guaranteed. That is not surmise. So I think you need to have that perspective to realize that, all things pass. Life has changed, and history is just the study of change when it boils down to it.
How do you escape? Because I know you must have faced this at one point. You were married. You had two children pretty rapidly. You had to provide an income. You could live on nothing, but you had to provide food for your family,
sure.
Certainly, too, and your children. So how do you allow yourself to follow that which may be unique and maybe explore various different options until you really find something that will fly for you with the need to bring home money?
In my case, it was probably a congenital stubbornness. And I can recall, when the kids were young, there were nights I would just sort of lie there and do the math in my head to see whether or not I could add up this project, this project, this project, and this project, and get to the end of a year without doing something else. And it was always, and I think that's true in life, there are opportunities, but there's also just luck. And there were projects that were not necessarily waiting, but they were there kind of when I needed them. So it's not as if, I don't feel like I was a trapeze artist, who was able to grab to one swing when I had exhausted another. I wasn't quite that precarious. But there was something there in cases where I needed it to be. And some years were obviously leaner than others. And that's the nature of freelancing. There is no sustainable rhythm. It's always too much or too little. And there were years when it was too little. But a lot of it was, just kind of dogged persistence. And in my case, kind of a blend of commissioned work, including work for some large companies like a Northwestern Mutual or a Miller Brewing, that certainly were essential to paying the bills and, in a sense, making some of the more community-oriented work possible.
I always remember, except I can't remember anymore who told this to me, but I've talked to so many people over the years that the sign of a good life, which is from the Torah, is to plant a tree, have a child, and write a book. So I'm looking at you and I'm thinking, I think you've probably done the tree thing too. You must be pretty satisfied with the course of your life, at least so far.
Yes, I feel lucky to have made a living at something that other people might consider a hobby, and that for me has always been a matter of love. And a lot of it is based on my own sense of both ownership and belonging of and to this community. And
yes,
a lot of what I do, as I told the graduating class, is to try to use the history of our community, the story of our community, to be kind of our shared story into which all of our individual stories, somehow flow. And that sense of shared story is, I think, what makes community.
What about the sense of place? Do you think that the students you were speaking to will have a strong sense of place, or will their generation be far-flung?
These students were from 38 states and 38 countries.
Oh, my.
And that was sort of skewed toward the grad students. They come from all over the place. I think 78% of the undergrads were from Wisconsin when they enrolled. But it was, as most colleges are, quite diverse. So they may not, certainly in most cases, they will not be Milwaukeeans, and no, they're not going to invest in Bayview or River West or Harambe or Story Hill or Washington Heights, but they'll always live someplace. They'll always have a possibility of attachment someplace. And I think for a lot of young people these days, and again, some of the younger people in Milwaukee, there's a hunger for that kind of attachment, that kind of investment, that kind of equity in place. And I find that tremendously encouraging. And I think a lot of that may be sort of an instinctive, very visceral reaction to kind of the anonymity, the impersonality of social media and kind of the digital wilderness, that we all walk in. I think people have a strong sense of desire for something tangible. Our kids as well. One's a teacher out in British Columbia, and he certainly has a strong sense of place out there. And our son in agroecology, he very intentionally lived in the West Coast, lived in the East Coast, and moved back to the Midwest because this was where his roots are.
Right.
And I think he's here for the duration.
I did the same thing. I traveled all around and came back to the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
There is something, tell me what it is, Mr. Historian, about the Midwest that's... it's a solid place to live. I like it here.
I think a lot of it is what you might describe as temperamental imperatives. You know, just kind of who we are, and who we are is shaped in part by where we live, where we grow up. And it's not just the physical geography, but all the expectations, all the normative behaviors that come from growing up in an area where ethnicity matters, you push it too far and you get to the stereotype of Lake Wobegone. But I recall I went to 4 years of school in Boston, and I never felt rooted there.
Really?
I never felt a sense of attachment. Love the history, even though I was an English major. But I always knew I'd come back here. You know, there was just part of it. Those kids were really fast. They could sort of run circles around us. You know, these relatively naive Midwesterners. and there were a lot of people. In my class came from the Midwest and had much the same reaction. And a lot of that is kind of in a sense, what you're born for and what you're born to.
Yes.
And there's a certain sense of you have to be honest to your roots, and at the same time avoid being kind of a homer. You know, this is the only place on earth that has the means of sustaining the good life. It's not, but it's one in which I certainly have found a real fit here.
John Gerda is our guest this hour. He was the commencement speaker at UWM. We liked the speech so much that we thought we would invite, as he describes himself, a guy who's been freelancing for more than 40 years and hasn't had a real job since 1972. So who better to have talk about the future and the messages that are important for those who are graduating? And it's not just those who are graduating. I get a kick out of listening to some of these speeches and like John's very much, but we're going to hear little snippets of other famous people who delivered commencement addresses not only this year but in years past. And we'll be welcoming your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Put yourself in the position of giving a commencement address. What do you think graduates right now need to hear? Maybe you remember, or maybe everybody says pretty much the same thing and you forgot who your commencement speaker was, but perhaps there is somebody listening who heard a terrific speech and you heard advice that you've carried with you your whole life. So we'd like to hear from you. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. You can leave messages there as well. We'll ask John to read a part of his address that he found inspired himself during the course of this hour as well. Here's Vice President Joe Biden at the University of Pennsylvania in 2013.
By the time you stand before your children graduating from this great university, much of what I said will already have happened. All these things are on the horizon, and all of it will not only change the way we live, but will create millions upon millions of new good-paying jobs. And you're a part of it. In fact, you're going to build it. You will take advantage of it. So today, for all the uncertainty you may feel, never forget, the future is within your control. Don't listen to the cynics. That's the only piece of advice I will give you, and of which I am absolutely certain. They're wrong about my generation, and they're wrong about yours.
We'll go to your phone calls momentarily, but we wanted John to read at least a portion of his commencement address to the 2013 graduates at UWM, and we asked him to choose whatever he wanted. So
I thought I'd choose, Kathleen, the most commencement-ish of the passages. I told my story, the rather circuitous path I followed, and talked about a couple of lessons that might be applied in their lives. I said, the first and most obvious is to follow your passion. Now, there's a commencement cliche, but I stand here as proof that it's possible. Try to find work or create work that you want to do, something that feeds you emotionally as well as financially. I know that's easier said than done, and it's more complex as well. A lot of you are probably asking right now, so what's my passion? Where do I get one of those? Passion doesn't strike like lightning. It rarely begins in a blaze of glory. It more often starts as a small fire that you feed twig by twig, then branch by branch. And how do you find that fire? How do you feed it? By knowing who you are. You've taken a lot of courses during your college career, but your most important subject by far has been yourself. You learn the essentials by now. The goal is to build a career that makes full use of four things that are related but different: your values, your interests, your talents, and your skills. In other words, look to what you believe, what you enjoy, what you've always been good at, and what you've learned to do. And while you're at it, pick a path that can do the world some good. I know that's a tall order. No job satisfies all those criteria all the time. No work is without its frustrations and disappointments and challenges. Hardship is part of being human. Expect dead ends. Expect power failures, but don't lose sight of the stars you steer by. If you pursue a passion as well as a paycheck, you're bound to do better work and come home a happier human being.
I like that. And I find it interesting you put values first in the list of four. It's important.
Sure. Has to be. Has to be.
Yeah. Your phone's on. Let's go to phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. John Gerda is our guest this hour of the program, and we're talking about inspiration you receive from commencement speeches. Tom in Rhinelander. Hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine,
well, John, I can't make our friend's supper tonight, but I'm getting my John fix up here in Rhineland. It's really what a great surprise to hear you on the radio this morning. But I wanted to say that my experience was such that I started my first job at $10,000 as a lawyer, it was peanuts, but it allowed me to do what I wanted to do, and that was work for what was then Milwaukee Legal Services and represent low-income people in a variety of different contexts. And in one way or another, I kind of did that all through my career until, interestingly enough, it branched off in the last 10 or 12 years into more executive-type management positions. So I guess, the advice I love there is go with your values and your skills. Sometimes I think I'd have made a better forester than a lawyer, but nonetheless.
I always came up high in farmer and forester in those vocational aptitude tests.
The value thing always did me well. I didn't ever make a lot of money, but I never had trouble sleeping at night as a result of what I did during the day.
Yeah, good for you.
Yeah.
That's one of the key things. So, it's great to hear you. I really liked that portion of the speech. I didn't even attend my graduation ceremony from undergrad. That shows you what kind of a goof off I was. But
I know what generation you are as well.
Say hi to everybody this evening. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, John. Thanks so much for the call. He talked to me about maybe being a better forester. You include this too. I suffered from this as well when I was in my 20s, and so I did all kinds of different things. But you say that you need to get on with it. Don't be paralyzed by the choices before you. Recall being visited, you say, by that fear in my 20s. Committing to one thing meant rejecting all of the other things you could do in your life.
I asked my kids, the two are in grad school, what to tell them. And they said, don't lie, was their first advice. but then they said, a lot of people that they know have that issue of committing to something, and part of that is relationships, certainly, but in terms of how you spend your life, sort of the state of perpetual possibility that is the lot of a student's life.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you are.
Mm-hmm.
You're just potential, and kind of committing to something is an exercise in certainly it's a harder task than it seems to be in retrospect. So, no, I put that in there for my kids that, yes, you do have to make a commitment. Yes, you do. And they have. You know, they've chosen their directions. But it's a struggle for so many young people, and certainly it was for us. You do have to close 10 doors when you open one, but that's okay because you cannot live in a state of perpetual possibility.
I don't know if you were. I used to be a fan for a while of Harry Chapin.
Sure.
And interviewed him when I was very young, and he was really young. But I remember that song, The Story of a Life. Do you know that song by Harry Chapin?
Which one?
It's called The Story of a Life, and it's just about that. All the girls I never kissed, never did.
Yeah.
And it really rang true then, and it probably still rings true. It'll always ring true.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thanks, Tom, for the call. Jim in Shawano. Hi.
Hi,
Jim.
Well, my clown name is Jimbo, and I'm a shrine clown, and my granddaughter was living with us several years back, and she came home and said they couldn't find a commencement speaker for Gresham High School, and being a good guy, I said, I'll do it as Jimbo.
In makeup?
Oh, yeah, makeup.
Okay.
And so what I did was I measured the stage. It was 45 feet across, and then I made a banner that was 90 inches, or 90 segments, I should say, and I got up on a stage and I said, okay, kids, I have 15 minutes to affect the rest of your life. And I said, I'm going to walk down here. I'm going to show you where you are right now. And I went down to 16, 17, 18. And I said, this is where you are right now. And I walked the stage and I said, this is where you're going. This is how much time you probably will have and maybe even more. So each one of these is a year. And I said, so if you go to school for, say, tech school for 2 years, you're at 20. If you go to a university, you're at 22. That's not really a lot, is it? And then I walked the stage and I said, you know, this is what you got going for you. Then if you go get a decent job, your careers and everything, you start a family. You know, I broke it up into segments and I said, if you think you're going to get married at 18, just think you're going to be married to that toad all these years, you know. I got it growing out of the audience and everything else. Well, as it turns out, I did have an effect on a couple of students. One kid decided to go to a tech school. One kid looked at it and said, you know, going to university, that isn't that bad, is it, 4 years? And then one guy ended up not getting married. So,
well, I think if you had a clown on stage, you'd say, these are the shoes you have to fill.
Thanks, Jim, very much for your call.
Thanks, Jimbo.
Yeah, probably a lot of people would say they'd like to have Stephen Colbert speak at their commencement address. We have gathered some clips of various people, and this is Stephen Colbert at Knox College in 2006. You never know what's coming your way, and part of this is you can't live with a script necessarily. You need to improvise, because that's what will happen.
Well, you are about to start the greatest improvisation of all, with no script, no idea what's going to happen, often with people and places you have never seen before, and you are not in control. So say yes. And if you're lucky, find people who will say yes back. Now, will saying yes get you in trouble at times? Will saying yes lead you to do some foolish things? Yes, it will. But don't be afraid to be a fool. Remember, you cannot be both young and wise. Young people who pretend to be wise to the ways of the world are mostly just cynics. Cynicism masquerades as wisdom, but it is the farthest thing from it, because cynics don't learn anything, because cynicism is a self-imposed blindness, a rejection of the world because we are afraid it will hurt us or disappoint us. Cynics always say no. But saying yes begins things. Saying yes is how things grow. Saying yes leads to knowledge. Yes is for young people. So for as long as you have the strength to, say yes. And that's the word.
That's the word. Stephen Colbert. That's a good one, isn't it?
Yep.
Yeah, say yes.
There's another good one. Leo Kottke, the guitarist, got a degree from UWM Beck, I think 2009 or so, and they gave me a copy of his address. I asked for it after I gave mine. And he told the story. It was the lesson was persistence, doing what you say you're going to do, commitment. He told the story of Homer and Jethro, who showed up at a show where there was no audience whatsoever. They honored their contract by doing the entire show and then went with no one there, not a soul, and then did an encore.
Oh, John!
That was a great story.
That is just a great story. I'll remember that one. Let's go to Lori in Delavan. Hi, Lori.
Hi.
Hi.
I have the opposite experience from all these great speeches. When I graduated from UW-Whitewater in 1979, we had some state representative. And he got up there and he said, you know, you think you're going to change the world and you think you're going to be happily married and you have this great family. And then he said, but you're not. You know, life is hard. You're going to screw up. You're not. And it was just the most depressing
it sounds like it.
Ever. And it turned out he was indicted for, like, cocaine usage and taking bribes and malfeasance in office, like, a week later. But, I mean, it was a speech I remember. Like I said, I don't remember his name, but you remember that and go, whoa, you know.
Oh, my goodness.
Fortunately had the experience of 2 years later, I got my master's degree. We had a far more positive speaker. But we just sat there looking at each other like, is he really saying this?
I hope they didn't give him an honorary degree.
Yeah, no, he wasn't. I mean, okay. He just came and gave the speech. But it's like, oh my, it was, I mean, people who didn't want to slit their wrists half the time were surprising.
So he
sat there for 4 years in classes and, you know, just struggled to make it. And then he goes, yeah, it's not going to matter anyway.
So he obviously had some demons that he was confronting. I'm sure he was not asked to give an address anytime.
No. Thank you, Lori, very much for your call. We have lines open. John Gerda is our guest this hour. John gave the commencement address to students at UWM in the spring just a little while ago, and we saw it. It was in the Journal Sentinel, and we thought, hey, we like this. So we invited John to be with us to share what it's like to give in a commencement address and what inspires people and what's pertinent to 2013. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Facebook comment from Mary Beth. I can't remember exactly who she was or what she said, but I believe she may have been the State Secretary of Education. What did impress me was that a person of her stature and accomplishment would take the time to speak to us. It was an important occasion. We and what we had done and could do, would do, were important.
Okay, who was your speaker, Kathleen? Do you recall?
I didn't go.
You didn't go?
No.
Same generation.
Yeah. I had to do an extra semester because, well, this will show you the times. It was in the 60s, and I kind of dropped out of school to campaign for a presidential candidate, who I really don't want to say who it was, but I just wrote my teacher's notes and saying, I'm sorry, I just won't be able to complete my courses this semester because I have to go to campaign to stop the war in Vietnam. And they said, okay, so I just left, and then I had to graduate the summer, and there really wasn't a formal address at all. You know, those were the days. Those were the days.
Yeah, mine was Buckminster Fuller.
I would have thought he would have been inspirational. He's quite an interesting man. But
He certainly was. But what I recall is, you know, this rather abstracted figure on this large stage with strap-on glasses who sort of, it was almost as if he turned on a Bucky tape and kind of ran it for a while, and someone actually had to pull on the hem of his gown to get him to sit down.
No. Oh, my.
So I don't recall a thing he said.
Oh.
I mean, we were impressed that he was there, but in terms of conveying a message, he was perhaps not the most effective choice.
But you can always say, my commencement was Bucky Fuller. Yeah, that's good. Rich and Rhinelander, hi.
Hi, I've been listening, and I did hear the initial comments about, you know, it may not, your job, your future may not be all about the money, but I generally work against that in terms of talking to people, especially liberals, about avoiding going where the money is, because I think wherever you wind up, you should learn to love it, and if you're not wanted there in that particular position, if you're solid in your values and you know what you're about, you should try to change it. I work in what is considered one of Wisconsin's most conservative reliably conservative counties for 34 years at a tech school. And as an out gay person on that campus, I can tell you that I made a difference on that campus. And I don't know if it lasted. I do know that it was uncomfortable a lot of the time because I was not culturally fitting within the environment. And so, Kathleen, you just mentioned anti-war activities. If you're going to be anti-war, you don't go to the people who are already anti-war. You go to the people you want to convince, and you learn to love it in terms of saying I can make a difference. And you can make some money in the process, by the way.
Mm. So what was the difference, being a man who was gay, who was openly gay on that campus? You said you made a difference. What was it?
Well, we had some tentative student organizations that sprang up and then died down, but really faced off with some of the cultural values in that county. That work still needs to be done, but I'm no longer in that county, so I don't worry about it. And I think wherever you go, you find people who are going to give you a hard time, whether you're the first woman, the first black person, the first disabled person in that position or whatever. And I just heard, you know, the job isn't about the money, but I think sometimes particularly liberals will say, well, I don't need to make a lot of money.
Right.
I say, make as much money as you can, mm-hmm. give it to Wisconsin Public Radio, and then be satisfied with your life, okay?
Yeah, the ideal mix is to do well by doing good.
Yes.
And that's a harder
yes.
one. And your role certainly took more courage than a lot of the rest of us have had to face. And I think that role of witness is vitally important.
Mm-hmm. You've had a good life, Rich. We know Rich. He went to Washington with us. He's you've had a good life. Thanks so much for your call, Rich. Let's go to, is it Dee in Burlington?
Yes.
Hi, Dee.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
I graduated from Columbia College Chicago in 1985, where Studs Terkel was.
Oh, one of my favorite people. Mm.
And we had read, you know, some of his works, so it was very exciting. And his basic message was, you know, your lives are going to be little, at least at first, but those were the important things to notice, and those were the things to fuel you for your work. Because, you know, the little people are what make the world.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, good advice, good advice. He was one of my heroes as well.
Was he? Mm-hmm. Yeah. He taught me so much. He was a huge influence on my life, but broadcasting life. But there's also this idea of paying attention. A lot of people don't pay attention to all that's going on. You know, all the people in all their different jobs and what people are thinking and being aware, in tune with what's going on around you, I think, is part of what Studs, and then making the connections of why that's happening.
Yeah,
it's really a good way to live.
Absolutely. And I think there's, if there's one gift, if I could give everyone a gift, it would be the gift of curiosity.
Yes.
You know, just
yes.
a sense of inquiry about kind of who we are here. You know, how does all this stuff fit together? And what's, my wife says that there are two kinds of people, those who ask questions and those who don't. And you can be at a gathering, and it's amazing how many folks, you know, are pretty focused on kind of what their little corner of the world is, and it's just a whole lot more interesting to ask
I
the
know.
Questions.
I know it is. You're right.
You've made a living at it, Kathleen.
That's what I do.
Yep.
And I don't know if he put this on his tombstone, but it was in some of his book. A lot of his books. Studs used to say, you know, at the end of his life, they would never say about him, "Curiosity killed this cat."
Yeah, right.
Which is good. That's a good message as well.
Absolutely.
Thanks very much for the call, Dee. We'll welcome more of your phone calls. 800-486-8655. We're talking about commencement addresses, the wisdom that you received that maybe you grew into because, as somebody said, you can't be young and wise. Stephen Colbert in one of these addresses. John Gerda is our guest. And John has joined us frequently on the show. We were really liking the address that he gave to students at UWM, so we thought we would give him the tall task of inspiring everybody and talk about the words that you heard at your commencement speeches and what students are hearing today. And Welcoming your calls at 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is Conan O'Brien, the year 2000, giving the address at Harvard. And he talked about, and John had some of this theme in his address as well, your story never ending.
I'd like to begin by thanking the class marshals for inviting me here today. The last time I was invited to Harvard, it cost me $110,000. So I was reluctant to show up. Today, I'm as nostalgic for the bad as I am for the good. So that's what I wish for all of you. The bad as well as the good. Fall down, make a mess, break something occasionally, give this guy a hard time. Know that your mistakes are your own unique way of getting to where you need to be. And remember that the story is never over.
A portion of another speech, Melinda Gates, Duke University in 2013.
I don't want you to connect for connection's sake alone. I want you to connect because I believe it will inspire you to do something, to take action, to make a difference in the world. Humanity in the abstract will never inspire you the way meeting another human being will. Poverty is not going to motivate you to do something, but meeting people, that will motivate you to do something.
Melinda Gates at Duke. You, I don't know how you, I want you to amplify on this. There is a tendency in all of our lives at different times to just sort of stay asleep, you know, to stay in bed. You got to drag yourself to get up and maybe do something you don't want to do, or you don't have things figured out, or you're going through a bad time. I like your advice, which sounds simple, but it really is fairly profound, that you have to start somewhere. You have to get out of bed. You have to engage with the world. You have to get off the sidelines. You got to be there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, get on with it. No, was
get
was
on
the
with
basic
it.
Advice. And I think, you know, and I know you know, friends who've had children, young adult children, who have kind of waited for that perfect job, and some of them are still unemployed.
Mm-hmm.
It's vitally important to start somewhere. In my own case, this is back again in the late 60s, but it was, you know, part of the ethic of being part of the solution and not part of the problem, you know, working at a youth center in Turning House on the South Side. So that was, you know, back in those years, you know, a relatively common path. That path is still there. You know, there are still things you can do.
Yes.
Ranging from, you know, some of the AmeriCorps or teaching year programs, starting on a volunteer basis, and that, you know, Melinda Gates, the advice about connecting. I know there are ways to engage, to get involved, that don't necessarily mean, you know, Mickey D's or check out a Target. No, there are lots of ways to engage the world. But starting is absolutely vital. In my case, I began to write, and I was writing stuff for free just because I felt excited, energized, you know, by the subject matter, and somewhat to my surprise, found out that other people, you know, shared that interest, and, you know, one thing has led to another.
Yeah. Let's go to Craig in Duluth. Hi, Craig.
Hi. I had an interesting experience of graduating from University of Wisconsin Oshkosh in January of 1967. The commencement speaker was, or the acceptance speech by the graduates was given by a man by the name of Tom Curley, who went on to become a stand-up comedian. And this is during the time of Vietnam, when all the males were going to lose their school deferments for the draft. So It was kind of a crazy time. Well, Tom got up and gave a complete nonsense speech. It was filled with all sorts of phrases such as, "Ladies and gentlemen, we are gathered here today as it has been in the past and will be in the future forevermore the way it was." And it was wonderful to watch the president of the university lean forward in his chair and try to make sense of what this man was saying. And the rest of us were all laughing and giggling. But they let him finish. He went on for about 20 minutes and absolutely nothing in 20 minutes.
So he kind of went to the Cliché Finder app and just did 20 minutes of clichés.
Sounds like fun. That's exactly what he did. And it was so apropos at the time because I remember being there thinking, you know, what's going to happen in the next 2 months? Well, I'm going to get drafted. So right. Why should I even start my career? And so it was a time of clichés, and we certainly didn't want to face what the reality was going to be.
Well, it's a whole lot better than the Whitewater speaker saying, it's terrible to be you.
It's true. And you bring up, and Craig, I remember those times well, too. A lot of people were facing huge choices. Some people moved out of the country because of that war. It was quite a time. But there is something, and I'm sure that you were very aware of this, John, when you spoke. This is an occasion. This is an important time in somebody's life. This
sure.
is... You were addressing people who are facing some fairly large decisions in many ways.
It's a genuinely big deal.
It is a big deal. You're right.
And it was so big, he chose to make fun of it. So I thoroughly enjoyed it, had a great time. I was probably, you know, at least a six-pack of beer already. But that's why it was so enjoyable, I think.
So I wonder if that made its way into a stand-up act for the next 10 years.
I don't know what happened to Tom. I saw him advertised a few times, but I don't know what he's doing now.
Thank you, Craig.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thanks very much for the call. We have time for a couple more phone calls, 800-486-8655. Did you, in preparation for this, listen to other graduation addresses, commencement addresses?
No, not at all. Try to avoid it. Absolutely. I think I did talk to a friend who's a speechwriter, and he said that he sort of follows the trade, and he said that there are two ways to do it. One is traditional and one is the anti-speech. And one of the fashions has been kind of the anti-speech, which is to, you know, sort of spin the cliches, you know, sort of make light of the whole exercise, because it is kind of the, as I described it, the last bastion of the cliche. The platitude. And I think the only one that maybe close is the wedding toast in terms of cliches per minute. So I tried to walk a line between avoiding the cliches and at the same time saying something that they could find useful. And as my kid said, don't lie, to be
right.
honest.
Yeah, which is also a good way to live. Walt in Fort Atkinson, hi.
Good morning. Say, when I graduated from UW Parkside a long time ago, the commencement address was titled "Beware of Unexamined Assumptions." And I thought that was pretty smart idea at the time, and I've considered it good advice. I've tried to follow that as much as I can these many years, so that's all I've got today.
Who was your speaker?
Thanks.
Who was the speaker?
You know, I don't remember. It was the vice chancellor.
Okay.
You know, this is 40 years ago or so. So that's all I can remember about it, but it was, you know, that was enough.
Mm-hmm. Yep, good line to remember.
Yeah, thanks, Walt. Kenneth in Janesville, hi.
Hello, I'm sorry for turning the pot upside down, I mean the flower pot, but the importance of knowing our roots from where we come from, I mean like 200 years back or 500 years back or even 1,000 years back, that all of this is along a line from a very, very long line before us. I mean, the sooner we know where we're from, I think the more of an impact, better off we are.
Yeah, I agree absolutely. Yep, and I've said time and again that the only place the future has to come out of is the past. So knowing the past is pretty vitally important.
Yeah, thanks very much for the call. Let's go to one more phone call. Alice Ann in Racine. Hi, Alice Ann.
Hi, how are you? My name is Alice Ann Connor, and I knew John.
Hi, Alice, how are you?
A long time ago from another life.
You were the ethnic reporter.
I worked at the Milwaukee Journal,
sure.
And I was writing an article, and John was kind enough to give me a paper that he had written that helped me in my research. But and it was a wonderful paper, and it helped me so much, but without realizing it, I had taken this beautiful sentence that John wrote. He is, by the way, a tremendously gifted writer. And I took that sentence and made it the lead of my story. And it was subconscious. I didn't realize I had done it. But he called me on the phone and he said, Alison? I said, yes. He said, you know, I worked very hard to write that sentence.
We have about 5 seconds, Alison.
Yeah. And I just wanted to say, he taught me a lesson, and I never again.
Thank you so much for the call.
Thank you, Alice. John Gerda. Nice to hear from you.
Thanks. Thanks for having done that speech. You got some mileage out of it, too. Thank you. John Gerda, Milwaukee historian, our guest this hour on commencement addresses. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning, who produces this program.